And welcome to another Raincoast Books podcast, this week featuring Anthony Bourdain and his new book, The Nasty Bits. Anthony Bourdain is a true celebrity chef, and though he really doesn't like that title, there's no doubt about it. He's a best-selling author, executive chef at a Tony New York restaurant, and host of his own TV show, No Reservations. But this is Bourdain we're talking about, so you've got to jettison any notions you have of the sweet and engaging, ever-so-convivial chef you've seen on every TV talk show. His best-selling book, Kitchen Confidential, introduced us to the gritty and not-so-nice world of the restaurant business, and in the process revealed Anthony Bourdain as a tough-talking, hard-drinking, chain-smoking New Yorker, a chef who, yes, trained at the Culinary Institute of America, but who was also a heroin junkie, a guy who kicked the habit the same way he approaches everything, by working hard, by never giving up, and by being stubborn as hell. His newest book, The Nasty Bits, is a collection of stories and articles. Reading it is like taking a whirlwind tour of the world, trying to keep up with Chef Bourdain's many encounters, his late nights, incredible intake of food and booze, as he researches articles, films his TV show, or just heads out to visit places he's heard have great food. Bourdain's lack of sleep never seems to slow him down, and his description of the people and places and food made me ravenous. So the plan was meet Anthony Bourdain at his hotel at 7 in the morning so I could tag along on his jam-packed press interview day in Vancouver. In all, there were five of us in Bourdain's posse for the day, two people from Raincoast, a writer from the local online magazine, and Anthony's assistant. We'd spend the day doing what he did, going from interview to interview, to book signing, piling in and out of the car, driving across town, only to repeat it over and over. And in between, questions and conversation. Today's podcast is the first of three with Anthony Bourdain and is an introduction to Bourdain's world.
So do you ever get any questions that surprise you anymore?
In Japan, it's really weird, okay, because what is appropriate and inappropriate are different. So, you know, to have this very shy, sort of giggly Japanese female journalist saying, "Ah, so Bourdain-san, and what is your favorite color? Blue. And how big is your penis?" So, it's like, that shocked me. But this wasn't kooky crazy. This was like a, you know, legitimate interview, and there's what is appropriate and inappropriate is different there. Also, the segue was a little alarming, you know?
Oh, they were. Yeah.
Every once in a while, you'll get just a really provocative one where someone's clearly looking for you to say something outrageous.
And you don't do that on purpose.
Yeah. I mean, I generally see it coming, you know? Somebody's looking for me to slag Jamie Oliver, you know? But generally, oh, okay, sure.
Or Woody Harrelson, I guess.
Well, that doesn't take any prompting.
Do you like being on show?
On my show?
No, do you like being on show like this, like being trotted out and displayed?
I don't care. I mean, you know, having been a heroin addict is really good training for a career in the entertainment business because, you know, anytime you think, wow, this is really undignified or humiliating, you just, you know, I think back of, you know, borrowing money from my mom under false pretenses or, you know, stealing purses on the subway or selling my stuff on the street. So it's, you know, undignified compared to what, you know? It's nice to know how low you were willing to go before you get into television.
That's a really profound notion, though, that, you know, you're a media star, but as you say, nothing is quite as demeaning as other things you've been through. And do you find that as you're going through these various things that you're doing television shows all over the world, you're meeting all sorts of people, you're encountering every day all these bizarre circumstances that, you know...
I'll answer this way. It's like, I always like to keep, you know, sort of foremost in my mind the very real possibility that I'm wrong, maybe even about everything. I'm grateful for the fact that when you travel a lot, especially, you know, I mean, I had a fairly sheltered existence in a kitchen for all those years, so it's all new to me over the last 5-6 years to be able to travel. The thing about travel, you're forced to learn. you know, just to like feed yourself breakfast in a country where you don't speak the language, you know, takes a certain amount of, you know, often painful acquisition of knowledge, meaning it's embarrassing to get it wrong in Japan, you know, when you walk into a place, it's all Japanese, the signs are in Japanese, you don't speak, obviously, the language. It's sort of, you know, point and smile. You know, so it's fun. It's fun sometimes being wrong. It's fun overcoming one's fear of humiliating oneself, or looking silly or awkward, or you know, or just being, you know, wrong about a place or a people or you know, something you absolutely believe. You know, that happens to me all the time. You know, I honestly believed absolutely that New York was the center of the world when I, you know, and then I went to Beijing and Tokyo and Singapore, and you're thinking, well, you know, if it is, it, you know, it won't be for much longer.
And the thing that you learn when you take those chances or discover that you're wrong are pretty interesting, aren't they?
I don't know. I mean, compared to what? You know, I don't want to make myself sound like, you know, I'm in the special forces or something. I mean, I'm living pretty large. You know, I sleep on a fair amount of, you know, cold, you know, bare ground or, you know, longhouses, boats, planes. But, you know, on the other hand, I also spend a fair amount of time in nice hotels. So, you know, chances, you know, the most dangerous thing that I face most of the time is a bout of diarrhea and projectile vomiting.
Thank you very much for stopping by and chatting with us. It is 7:55. You're watching Breakfast Television.
Okay, so we got all sorts of questions from the internet.
Yeah.
Sherry in Kempville, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Most interesting gross Canadian dish you have tried?
Raw seal eyeball or brain,
and
kind of hard. Quite delicious. I mean, like sushi. Pretty terrifying looking.
I was gonna say
the taste was much better than it looked.
Because to put an eyeball in your mouth has got to take an act of faith.
It's sort of like a Concord grape, only fishier.
I don't know if I could do the eyeball.
Yeah, you could. Eyeball, it's so last week, you know? I mean, been there, done that, yeah.
Amber of Saskatoon, which country do you find has the most diverse food culture?
Diverse? Probably America, because we're, you know, New York City, there's no such thing as America. We're just a place that people from someplace else come. I mean, it's our greatest strength, is that we're a nation of immigrants, so a lot of whom bring their supply train and their dishes and their cuisine. I mean, you know, Queens, New York, that's what country has the most diverse cuisine.
Jen in the Chicago suburbs wants to know how you stay so slim.
Cigarettes, neurotic personality, fidgeting, an unhealthy lifestyle.
You know, actually she said more than that. She said she wants to know how you stay so slim and so handsome.
Oh, well, shucks, thanks.
Okay, and I've got one more here. Have you ever gotten ill from the food you've tried? And you've written about this, that sometimes does happen.
I've only been, you know, poisoned to the point of, you know, needing medical assistance, immediate medical assistance once in France, of all places. You know, every once in a while you spin the wheel, it comes up 00, and you spend a little quality time on a cold bathroom floor. Africa was not good to me, but no, nothing that really took me out of the game. You know, only time I missed a day's work was in France.
And what was the food?
3-day-old tête de veau, way too much foie gras, and too much sauterne first thing in the morning. I don't know which of those did it, but it was total system shutdown, you know, shock, chills, sweats, you know, I needed medical assistance. I needed a house call.
Now, do you have a food that if you're just, you wake up and you're hungry, is there something that you always fall to that is your fave?
Any time of day?
Yeah.
Oh, God, no, it depends. I mean, and sushi, I'm always ready for sushi. Good sushi. A utility sushi, when you've been to Japan and you've eaten at Masa, utility sushi will no longer do. You know, it's got to be good. Warm, crumbly rice, not too cold fish, aged just right. You know, it should, fresh sushi, the freshest sushi is not necessarily the best sushi. However, people might like to delude themselves that is the case. And of course, I love a good, you know, I love a good pastrami sandwich. You know, I tend to get sentimental about it because I don't get an opportunity to you know, to have a good deli, you know, when I'm traveling. It's something I miss.
The other thing that I was reading Nasty Bits, that because I worked as a busboy when I was a kid, mm-hmm. never worked in a restaurant. Yet all of the stuff you talk about in terms of the work ethic and the approach to work and the idea of getting up and really applying yourself, I think applies to almost any profession, anybody who wants to get ahead.
It's no accident that Chinese and Indians are going to be the workforce of the future. The managerial class are going to run the IT industry, our future masters, because they have a good work ethic. Show up on time, you know, do the best job you can. You know, that's not a lot to ask in any workplace, but apparently it's too much for a lot of us.
Well, I know that, I think one of the things you said that really resonated with me was the idea that there is no job that isn't my job.
Right.
You know, we need to get this done.
Right.
And there is no room for that's not my job.
Yeah. Especially in the restaurant business. You know, you can pretend to put on airs in the dining room, but, you know, when the grease trap blows up, you know, you're not cooking until it's fixed. So you may as well take a hand. You know, hey, I'd love to live in a socialist agrarian, you know, wonderland, think like the French, and, you know, hey, nice month-long vacation, and, you know, I need my nice long lunch, but, you know, I'll be unemployed. You know, that's the future is for those who are willing to work hard and with a single-minded dedication to being good, or to be maybe even being the best. You know, at least being, you know, taking work seriously. And I just don't, I look down on, frankly, you know, they tell me how much vacation they get in Europe, and, you know, calling in sick. I mean, that's unthinkable to me, you know. It's really sad when you see culinary students, you know, they've left a perfectly good job in, you know, the financial sector, or, you know, they think, oh, it's glamorous, it's good, it's, I'm gonna live out my dream of opening a bread and breakfast by going to culinary school, spending all that money, all that time, work a little bit in New York and in some busy restaurants to get my chops, and then I'll open the bed and breakfast of my dreams. You see these people come in. You know, you put them to work, and, you know, first Saturday night, you look across the line into their face, and you see in their eyes, you watch the dream die. You know, they realize people aren't nice here. This is hard. It's unglamorous. It's ooky. That's why I recommend that people who are thinking of culinary school, you know, go to work before you spend the money. Go to work in a restaurant as a dishwasher, as a prep cook. See if you're really cut out for the business. You know, people who like that kind of heat and pressure and madness, they're not normal people. You know, so maybe you're not right for the business. Find out before rather than later.
Hey, you work hard. You know, as much as you say the writing the books and the travel is not as hard as working in a restaurant, and obviously I believe you, but you work hard. You don't have to work this hard if you don't want to.
I feel lucky. I am lucky. I know I'm lucky.
Like,
I make a living writing. How few people pull that off?
And who do you want to most impress? Like, who?
I just want cooks, the cooks and restaurant people who read my books. I just, as long as they say, you know, that's not bullshit, I'm happy. That's enough for me.
Anthony Bourdain, his newest book is called The Nasty Bits: Collected Varietal Cuts, Usable Trim, Scraps, and Bones. It's published by Bloomsbury and distributed in Canada by Raincoast Books. You can buy it online from chaptersindigo.ca or amazon.ca. Easiest thing is to visit the Raincoast Books website and follow the links, and while you're there, check out some pictures from Anthony's visit to Vancouver. That's at www.raincoast.com/Bourdain. And there's more Bourdain to come. Next time, Anthony meets some of his fans at an early morning book signing.
Is your hand getting tired?
Nah. A lot easier than tourneying carrots.
I'm a big fan. Loved Cook's Tour. That's what got me out of the country, actually, to go to Asia. And I just think he's a great writer and great on television.
More Bourdain at Barbara Jo's Books to Cooks. That's next time on the Raincoast Books podcast. I'm Robert Wemet. Thanks for listening.